Welcome back. Paul McCartney says this may be the greatest song ever written, and I don't think he's too far off the mark. God only knows the Beach Boys. A blind mystic who predicted Brexit, 9/11, the rise of ISIS, and the Boxing Day tsunami also warned that Barack Obama would be the last U.S. president, and conspiracy theorists believe prophetess Baba Vanga may have foretold that something will happen to Donald Trump before he's sworn in on January 20th, 2017. God forfend, anything should happen. The Bulgarian, who died in 1996, aged 85, was known as the Nostradamus from the Balkans. She is revered in Russia for her 85% success rate when it comes to telling the future, with millions convinced that she possessed paranormal abilities. Now it transpires the clairvoyant made a staggering prophecy about the U.S. election. Back with my conversation with Thomas Colbert, the author of The Last Master Outlaw, How He Outfoxed the FBI Six Times, But Not a Cold Case Team. The D.B. Cooper case solved right here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. We are with Thomas Colbert, the author of The Last Master Outlaw, and Thomas insists he and his cold case team have cracked the D.B. Cooper case and identified him as Robert Rackstraw. If you go to dbcooper.com, the website, you can actually see video of the cold case team confronting Rackstraw. And as you say, Thomas, this is not the way an innocent person would behave. He's asked repeatedly, are you D.B. Cooper? And rather than just say no, like you would assume an innocent person would, you're wasting your time, I'm not D.B. Cooper, he says nothing.
He hid, so, he hid in a storage container for over an hour to avoid our cameras. This was after meeting him quietly the day before, sat down with him, and told him he needed to give himself up. When he didn't come to us by the 9 a.m. deadline the next day, we went back with the camera crew, with our armed former FBI, and he hid in a dumpster to avoid us. He finally had to come out, and that's what the audiences will see on the website.
Do you consider him to be a dangerous person?
Well, he was arrested for murder of his father. Many people, including myself, feel he got off of murder. He offered, and you'll see it in the book, he offered to kill someone else. He was in Vietnam, obviously, doing his service to the nation, and that involved, obviously, death. Absolutely, I think he could be, and that's the reason we have to be cautious around him. You mentioned his sister. Is this a
yes.
good time to chat about her?
Yes, please. That was my next question.
Linda, God bless Linda. She was one of six women. And that's, you know, the fascinating thing about this book is it was his women that gave him up. Half a dozen women. I mean, we have his sister. We've talked to two of his former wives. We've talked to a getaway gal that flew away with him on two escapes. We have a former Hollywood producer who, she was also a cocaine partner of his. If it wasn't for these women, we wouldn't have the book. And at least half of our 52 five-star reviews on Amazon are from women. He was definitely a Jekyll and Hyde ladies' man. Well, Linda, his sister, they had been out of touch since the 80s. I hadn't seen each other until I think the last time they saw each other was 91 at his son's wedding. And Linda came to believe eventually that while she defended him and felt he couldn't possibly have killed their stepdad, she turned when she finally realized several years later while watching, of all things, the O.J. trial. And as she told us on camera, she gave us a 4.5-hour interview. An interview she insisted on, even though she had recurring cancer. And when we found that out a few days ago, we wanted to stop the interview, and she said, no, I have to do it to give my dad a voice. And let me tell you, she gave the most stunning and chilling interview of growing up with a boy. She is among professionals and coworkers that say he was a sociopath from day one as he grew up. And a narcissist and a con artist. And that's where he turned. And as she said, joined the military. And while he received a lot of awards, she feels the military just fine-tuned him, learning how to in psyops training, in deception, propaganda, and other things. Linda gave the most compelling interview, and some of the highlights, 6 minutes of Linda's interview, is on the homepage of dbcooper.com, right next to the book cover. If people want to look and read some of the incredible reviews and testimonials, they're up there. And final point, Richard, the 102 pieces of evidence which were snuck into the court complaint for federal court, that's posted there too. If people want to read the evidence and make up their own mind, it's right there.
And so you are suing the FBI to reopen the case. When is that decision likely to be made?
Our first court date is December 1st. It is a scheduling day. That's where a judge is going to decide the next step. And we'll keep you posted if you would like to be.
I would love to be kept up to date. Thank you.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones. On the wild card line, Charles is in Ballston Spa, New York. Go ahead, Charles. Good morning.
Hey, thank you, Richard, for taking my call. This is actually a very fascinating subject for me, one that I've read a lot about, and I have a couple questions, if you'll permit me. The first is regarding whether or not D.B. Cooper has had any accomplices during his crime. I mean, that seems to be like a big subject that's not often discussed. I mean, there had to be a couple, or at least one or two guys that helped him out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering,
what was your other question? You had two?
Oh yeah, I had two. Yeah. And the second is whether or not Mr. Cooper was reptilian.
All right, let's stick with the first one. Thomas, go ahead. Accomplices.
Yeah, as far as accomplices, it was very interesting. There were documented by the FAA and later the FBI, the 5 days before the jump on the Saturday. Now, remember, the actual thing was the Thanksgiving Eve on Wednesday is when it happened. Well, the Saturday before, witnesses reported a small plane near Eugene, which is to the south, of course, of Portland, where this took off, a small plane at night dropping flares. And it was thought, when it was told to the authorities, the jump hadn't occurred, and 6 days later, those control tower people remembered the reports and reported it to the FBI. It has been thought that the plane was either practicing a jump location and using flares to find out where to jump at night, or disinformation, phony location, because he actually jumped in Washington State to the north. I will tell you, our suspect, we have 15 witnesses that our suspect was posing one of his 21 phony IDs. When he was kicked out of the Army, he went up there. He was living, according to witnesses, in two towns, Astoria and Corvallis. These 15 witnesses said he called himself Norman D. Winter. He was a baron from Switzerland, walking America. I'm not kidding. And he
had to give him points for originality.
Yep. And he befriended everyone. He knocked on strangers' doors in these two towns. Well, he was a grifter, and he was borrowing hundreds and hundreds of dollars quietly. And this is what the witnesses told us in two towns. And I tracked down these witnesses with the help of the first ones. And this was an embarrassing incident that was not told to law enforcement. It never left the town. We even asked the local paper, did you cover Norman D. Winter? I mean, and they said, no, they didn't. Well, the problem with the people I were talking to, they didn't own the paper in 71. The 15th witness that watched our History Channel special and remembered and looked, and there's Robert Rackstraw in a news video interview from 7 years after the jump, and this woman is looking at him saying, oh my gosh, that is Norman D. Winter. And this woman is sort of a pack rat. You meet a couple of people now and then that keep aisles of newspapers in their houses.
Sure, sure.
She starts digging, And she finds two articles in the Historian paper that the editors didn't even know about. They document how he stole thousands from the most affluent families in Astoria, how he went to the Admiral's Ball, the yearly ball, as a guest of Switzerland. There are several things in those articles, and if folks go up to dbcooper.com, on the homepage, towards the bottom, you're going to see an article with the Historian paper, and that Disneyland photo that is on Coast to Coast, that's on the front of the article. You'll know it's it. Read the old, not only the article update, but the two old articles were put up for viewers to read. It's incredible. And it totally blows away the FBI's argument, you can't trust these 15 folks. Why? Well, the newspaper verifies everything they told our team.
You know, here's a guy that, I mean, obviously he's got smarts.
Oh, yeah.
One of the first things that jumped out to me was that he was smart enough to ask for four parachutes.
Right.
Because knowing full well that the authorities could have obviously done something to his parachute. So, I mean, he's shrewd. He could have, he had a successful military career up until a certain point. He could have done so much with his life. Why do you have any insight? The women in his life, his sister, any insights as to why he decided to pull this caper off?
Well, you're talking to the son of a shrink. And my dad taught me how to read people on the phone. And when I and read people in person, of course, too. And when Linda told me this, what we nailed down with Linda, she explained that the problem with her brother is that he was never responsible for anything he did. The parents let him off. He was charming, as I said, a real Casanova ladies man, even in high school. Sadly, he got two high school classmates pregnant before he was 18. I mean, he was just very irresponsible. He'd crash a car drunk, and the neighbors that he hit, they loved him so much because of his personality, they didn't even tell his parents that he crashed the car. This guy had a life where he never, ever owned up for what he had done. And this is what Linda, you will see, and your listeners will see in her interview. She talks about he just had a life where he got away with everything, and he built on that. And that's how a con artist and grifter was created.
The wild card line, Frank is in Hollywood, California. Frank, good morning. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
No, Richard, Hollywood, Maryland.
Ah, all right. Thank you.
Hollywood, Maryland. There was a Hollywood, Maryland long before there was a Hollywood, California.
All right. Thank you for that.
Mr. Colbert, the documentary was, it was so good. I was glued to the TV, and I didn't even take a bathroom break. I mean, I really enjoyed it. My question to you is about how could this guy be hired on any job with that record? I applied for a job one time where I had no criminal record. I had experience, and because my credit wasn't the greatest, they didn't hire me. So how could this guy get any kind of job in the United States? And my second question is a movie question.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Frank, what is it? We're listening.
Yeah, I have a can't-miss idea, and it would be better for a miniseries, but what is the difference when people make a movie, a blockbuster movie, a two-hour movie, as opposed to a miniseries? And it's not about the money. I mean, you'll make money either way, but could you comment on that?
Sure. I'll first comment on him. First of all, he lied to get into the military and become a lieutenant. He lied about two college degrees, said he went to USC and San Jose State, where he was a high school dropout sophomore years, self-taught genius in the library. I mean, this guy learned how to make cannons. He learned how to make man-sized gliders all by just reading books in the library. He got a phony license at 16 and started driving a cement truck, and that's when the lies started. Lied in the military. He was, when they were planning to get him out after lying about his college degrees, they realized, they found out all this history on him. And so he is a liar, and that's how he got where he was. As far as a movie, We've had discussions with several different studios and networks. The rage now is something called a limited series. There's no longer, oh, it has to be 2 hours. A limited series could be 7 to 8 hours spread over 1 hour a week for 6 weeks. And that's what they did with the True Detective series you may have seen on HBO. You've seen other series that the Hatfield and McCoys were 6 episodes. We have a 45-year story on this man. And he went from 22 different IDs, 21 states, 5-country trail, 6 separate careers, 3 families. And he, as I said earlier, he didn't escape once. He escaped 3 times by plane and once by river. It's a fascinating, fascinating story.
Is he still working or is he retired?
He is 73 years old. He was a professor, as I said, and head of the law department at a university for 10 years. He now runs a little boat shop in San Diego, and you can, and the audience, if they go up on your website, they can see his 45-foot yacht, which is now at a yacht club. And he's sometimes there. He's sometimes in a downtown condo. The name of the boat, you'll love it, is called Poverty Sucks.
Do you suspect did he buy that boat with his ill-gotten gains, do you suppose?
Well, I told you earlier there are twice that he met with Briggs for money exchanges. We have a witness that had him come in 1974, a drug middleman came home. He wasn't a drug middleman yet. He was working for a loan company. But his roommate was his old buddy, Dick Briggs. And Dick Briggs has his new boss from California there. And they're doing cocaine on his table, the middleman's table. And next to Mr. Robert Rackstraw is a gunny sack of money stuffed. Now, this is 2.5 years after the hijacking. I quickly asked the middleman who was telling this story, did that drug dealer deal with Krugerrands? Krugerrands was the money of exchange for the underworld in the 70s. They were illegal, as many people know, because of apartheid. That was the money exchange, and the answer was, yeah, he used to wear a couple of them around his neck. I learned within 4 years later, 2 witnesses told me that Rackstraw one time paid a bail in $60,000 worth of Krugerrands, and someone else saw his Krugerrands. We absolutely believe that money wasn't found because it went down to the Columbia cocaine gangs in exchange for Krugerrands.
Do you still have Rackstraw, your cold case team, do you still have him under surveillance?
We can't really talk about what we're up to, but I will tell you that this cold case team has not stopped.
Is he getting, is it your sense that he's getting nervous? I mean, are you hoping that he'll make some mistake?
Well, there's always hope. But, you know, there were some thoughts after the confrontation in San Diego, because on the first day, we'd actually offered him a movie deal when the FBI wouldn't charge this man, wouldn't investigate again. We told him if he turned himself in, we'll do a book and a movie. He'll make $1 million. This is what our various people in Hollywood said. But he had to turn himself in first, and we heard he'd get, 1 to 3 years, this was the estimate. 1 to 3 years, 20 years probation, and then he'd never have to buy a beer again. That's what we were told. Well, he turned it down. And on day two, as you know, we had to confront him again with the cameras.
All right, we'll take a time out. And when we come back, we'll take questions and comments for Thomas Colbert. Here's Rodriguez, the subject of a fascinating documentary, Looking for Sugar Man. Back with more of Coast to Coast AM right after this. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T. This is Astral Weeks by Van the Man, the Bard from Belfast. An increasing number of two-headed sharks, yeesh, has been found in the world's oceans in recent years. But scientists can't seem to agree why this is happening. Last month, scientists discovered an egg-laying shark embryo with 2 heads in a lab in Malaga, Spain. Previously, the only known 2-headed sharks were from species that give birth to live babies, according to the BBC. Anecdotal evidence suggests that the number of 2-headed sharks has been increasing since 2008, when a fisherman discovered a 2-headed blue shark embryo in the Indian Ocean, according to National Geographic. In 2011, scientists discovered conjoined twins in blue sharks caught in the Gulf of California and in northwestern Mexico. According to the website NationalGeographic.com, in 2013, fishermen off the coast of Florida caught a female bull shark that was pregnant with a two-headed fetus. Now, the big question is, how can we prevent this trend from inspiring yet another Sharknado sequel? Back with more of my conversation with Thomas Colbert, the author of The Last Master Outlaw, The D.B. Cooper Case Solved, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And we are back with Thomas Colbert, The Last Master Outlaw, how he, D.B. Cooper, outfoxed the FBI six times, but not a cold case team, and the website is dbcooper.com. Can we order the book right from the website, Thomas?
Yes, you can. Yeah, they can just click right on it.
Excellent. All right, back to the phones we go, and Joe is in the Bronx on the wild card line. Joe, good morning.
Hey,
welcome,
Richard,
to Coast.
How you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I wanted to ask Thomas, as far as ID evidence goes, is there any ID evidence, either fingerprint, DNA, or whatever, that would link D.B. Cooper on board that plane that he jumped from to Braxtra? I mean, have they done the comparison?
Yes, and you should know that the aircraft, when it landed in Reno, was the end of a six-city run. So there was dozens and dozens and dozens of prints from six different crew passenger loads. It was very sloppy back then. There was no CSI, no forensic organization. There was no cordoning the plane off. The first thing on the planes were the dogs looking for him hidden or a bomb. And of course, they were licking everything and eating the food that Cooper had bought for the crew. Then the cleanup crew started, and then they were chased off the plane. And then finally, they went in looking for prints. According to the FBI liaison that worked with our production for History Channel, there were about 70 plastic cups used. One cup was in Cooper's holder, according to an FBI agent who later wrote one of the key books. There were over a dozen Cooper books. This one has no suspect. It's just the history. And it's called D.B. Cooper, Dead or Alive. I recommend it to people for the history. This agent that wrote the book claimed that there was no print found on that cup except the stewardess. Well, you might think, what about the railway when he walked out and jumped from the back railway? That railway, according to the same agent, was smeared from top to bottom. Our Cooper knew about fingerprints, but there were seven letters mailed by Normandy Winter before the jump, when he was living, we believe, up there and became D.B. Cooper. And after the jump, there were four letters mailed by a D.B. Cooper, ha-ha, you can't find me type letters, sent to newspapers up and down the West Coast. They were discovered by someone who's been a guest on Coast to Coast, Galen Cook. And Galen is one of the several so-called Cooperites, so-called amateur researchers. He is also an attorney, very smart. He pushed and found those letters filed away by the original agents. And I credit him and others involved in this case, amateur researchers, that, again, I wouldn't be here not only for the women that gave him up, but the Cooperites that have laid some of the original work. Galen Cook found those letters. And what Galen didn't realize is, after I looked at the letters and read the transcript from Coast to Coast, the first and last letters were mailed 500 miles away from the crime scene in mailboxes 30 and 50 miles away from a small mountain town in the High Sierras where Mr. Robert Rackstraw lived for the next 18 months. Now, when my FBI guys and the cold case team heard that, they said, holy cow, that's an 8 out of 10.
Again, I'd say evidence
that the FBI won't look at.
Wild card line again. Ken is in Las Vegas. Ken, good morning.
Good morning. I actually met Bob Rackstraw at a aviation themed restaurant in Orange County in about 2002, and he and his friends were openly joking about him being D.B. Cooper.
Yeah. We have about a half a dozen incidents that have been documented, Kevin, and I'd love to get your number through the show. We'd love to chat with you about that incident.
Yeah, it was very interesting. They were leaving it all very vague.
Yes.
It was sort of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, maybe I am, maybe I'm not.
Yeah.
And he also offered an explanation about why he did it, or why he did it if he were D.B. Cooper. And that was that he was actually hired to do it by an agency of the federal government. It was kind of a false flag operation because the government didn't like the fact that this was before there was any, you know, searches going on board an airplane, and lawyers were leaving the country every weekend with suitcases full of cash to evade taxes for their wealthy clients. So this was all done as a very public stunt to get the public to accept the idea that you would be searched and screened before you boarded an airplane.
Well, that's the story we've heard, and we spent 6 months talking to Mr. Rackstraw, trying to get him to sit down to do an interview before we ambushed him in San Diego. So that was the story. Oh, the government put him up to it. He was trained by the CIA and Special Forces off the books. He was a pilot. He flew the general that led the Cambodian incursion. I mean, this guy's like Gump. He's everywhere.
Right. I was going to say Zelig, but you're right.
Yeah, that has been, I was hired by the government to test the system and find out how easy it was. And then it went south. Another story he told was, no, I was told it was hired to track Cooper down. It's all erroneous, and again, this is disinformation by Mr. Bob Rackstraw. I have heard the story you mentioned, Kevin. It's one of the many things he said, and as I stated, there are over a half dozen times that he claimed, I might be Cooper.
It was fascinating how he and his friends were all very open about it, and all of his friends were also pilots and aviation enthusiasts.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting.
Well, we believe it's posted online, in fact, with his third ex-wife, that when he had a heart attack and stroke in 2013, he admitted he was Cooper and said he did it with the help of Special Forces people. The real Cooper, while he knew to put the air flaps at 15 degrees and fly at 200 feet or whatever it was, so many miles per hour, he didn't know how to open the back stairwell. In fact, he thought the pilot had a button. No, he had to have the manual read to him on how to open it. So he did get some basic training. He was a parachutist, very talented, but he didn't know how to get out of the plane. So that tells me he did have help.
Ken, thank you for that. You mentioned earlier that you had offered him a movie deal if he would turn himself in, and you said what sort of time would he be facing? Because part of me was thinking that there would be a statute of limitations on this. But if they reopen the case and he were to be convicted, how much time would he get?
Well, first of all, it did expire. The charges expired at 5 years, but on the last day, just before sunset, a special agent in charge in Portland assembled a federal grand jury, and they slapped a John Doe indictment on it, which means if a John Doe is ever identified as Cooper, well, the law would kick back in. Half of those John Doe indictments have been thrown out by the higher courts. Half have actually worked. So it is a gamble by the U.S. Attorney's Office to rely on the John Doe indictment. And I'm sorry, the rest of your question.
Well, under the John Doe indictment, then, how much time could he face if he were indicted?
They were going to give him, according to, I'm quoting your former guest, Mr. Cook. Galen Cook said that agents had told him they were going to give him 35 to 45 years back then. But we're hearing now 3 to 4 years, again, 20 years probation. That's rough guesstimates of what he might get. And look, he's 73. He had a heart attack and a stroke. He's carrying a pacemaker. We don't think he's running far.
All right, west of the Rockies, Howard is in Vancouver, Washington. Howard, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Hello, Richard. Good to talk to you again.
Likewise.
Mr. Colbert, would you object too much if I try to shoot some holes in your theory?
Oh, please do.
Okay, November of 1971, what happened was pretty much was right over my head. I'm in Vancouver, mm-hmm. Washington. And in January of that year. I had just been discharged from the 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew a little bit about this. Now, my first impression at the time was that anyone who would attempt to parachute from that type of an aircraft at that speed and that kind of weather was a complete amateur. Now, I know it's always been assumed that this person had to have had some sort of special training. If they had, they wouldn't have attempted that. My guess is that this fellow went into that was very bad weather that night. I remember it very well. It was a stormy night. It was raining very heavily. There was a hard south wind blowing. And my guess is that when he went out of that plane, he went out where he saw light down below him. That was the only thing he would have had reference to. He went out over Portland, probably, because that's where the bright lights were. And with a south wind blowing, that would have put him right into the Columbia River. Now, let me tell you a little bit about the Columbia River for, you know, people who aren't familiar with it. At the point where we are, it's about a half mile across. It's one of the fastest rivers for its size in the world. It at times moves at 7 knots. Now, there have been a lot of things lost in there. Back in 1959, an International Guard F-89 Scorpion went into that river when it was on approach to Portland Air Base. They drug that river for weeks. It was never found. There were two crewmen aboard.
Mm-hmm.
It's still down there. It was. It's buried in the silt and the sand at the bottom of that river. And that's
pardon me, but your call is breaking up. If you could try to finish it quickly, I'll give you an answer.
Okay. I simply think that if you believe what these drug dealers have been telling you, I have a bridge to sell you here. Okay, that's basically it.
Well, so basically, to sum up, Howard is saying that the weather was so bad that it's quite likely that Cooper would have ended up in the Columbia River and surely drowned.
Correct. Well, first of all, thank you for your call. I will tell you the FBI, I believe they're correct to say that he landed in near, I believe it was Woodman Airport, off the I-5 freeway in Washington State. That's where they believe he landed. They did find the emergency door sign 4 or 5 years later, a few miles from that location. So he did not land in the river, we believe. And as far as how dangerous it was and difficult it was, this is a, as I said, trained by the special forces and had HALO training, high altitude, low open. He was trained to fall into trees, according to the experts. And we also tracked down his master parachutist commander from Vietnam. You can see his testimony on the website, dbcooper.com, and he says he absolutely believes he had the skill sets and the go-to-hell attitude to be DB Cooper.
All right, fine. I think we'll have time for one more here. First-time caller, Don is in Sacramento. Don, good morning.
Morning. How are you doing? Just two questions real briefly, and I'm sorry if you already brought this up, but first of all, how come none of the money was ever recovered in circulation? Even if he was laundering it from drug dealers, I would assume some of it would circle back up. And then the second is, on the History Channel special, they said that they showed the video of the guy that you think is it to the stewardess, and she said, no, that wasn't it, and what's your response to that? And I'll listen to the radio for the answer.
All right, thanks, Don. So the money, why didn't it recirculate?
I believe it was kept in South America, and it was sent off to Europe, sent off elsewhere. We understand the FBI was looking for the money only in North America.
All right, and the second question had to do with a stewardess on board that flight, and she was shown a picture, and she didn't identify.
You should know that our 18 strongest pieces of evidence, including DNA and forensics, which we were videotaped along for 3 days, we testified about our evidence. The strongest 18 pieces of evidence, for some reason, were cut out of the History Channel program. The readers or the listeners would have to ask History Channel why they did that. We were stumped. It obviously angered our cold case team, but it obviously was in line of closing the case, we believe. There was no forensics in DNA. And I'm sorry, the rest of the question, Richard?
I think those were the two.
Okay.
Oh, wait a minute. No, there was one more.
The stewardess.
The stewardess, yes.
Stewardess was presented. We tried to get Tina, is her name. She sat next to him for 4 or 5 hours. We tried to get her for a half a year. And she cordially denied and hasn't spoken since the Reno landing in 71, and she turned us down. Lo and behold, when History Channel did their final interviews with the FBI, and our cold case team and myself were not invited to Seattle as we were promised, and of course the door was shut on us, Tina suddenly sat down and gave an interview, looked at 4 of our pictures of our suspect, and said, "I don't think so." Then she looked at video of our suspect 7 years later with a beard and losing hair, and also said, "I don't think so." It only took me a week to do some research. 2 different FBI agents interviewed Tina in the 1980s separately. Both of them said in their interviews that she had severe trauma memory loss. I tracked down the other 2 stewardesses. They also had trauma memory loss. There was one person that did not have memory loss, and that was the college student sitting across from Cooper. We tracked him down. He's never been on American television until the History Channel. They interviewed him, and we put down 6 pictures, 6 different suspects, including our man. He pointed right at him.
Bingo.
You can read about that on page 2 of the D.B. Cooper website. We actually have the interview there and the book chapter on how that all turned out.
Any plans to confront Robert Rackstraw again?
Only in court. We'll see if the FBI changes their mind. Bottom line is the truth is out in a book. They wouldn't accept the investigative report, so we can let the audience make up their own mind.
The Last Master Outlaw, How He Outfoxed the FBI 6 Times But Not a Cold Case Team. Thomas Colbert, thank you for spending 2 hours with us on Coast this morning, and congratulations. It sounds to me like it's case closed.
Thanks, Richard. Great to talk to you.
dbcooper.com is the website. For George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyons, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Chris Burrows, Greg Bishop, Nathan Staten, and Donna Walker, and here in Toronto, Nathan Smith, Scotty Guest, and Jackie Lamport, I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. Until next time, so long for now.